introduce Steve Onions. He's one of the business guys here in church. And quickly give you a summary of his business background. Stephen has significant experience in telecommunications, information technology, software development, industrial engineering, automation, and business management that encompasses multiple disciplines in both engineering and corporate governance. In addition to engineering, Stephen has significant experience in business incubation, business development, and strategy, and he has significant experience in diversified project management. He's also an avid aviator with pilot license and instructor ratings. And he sits every Sunday and listens to my sermons. I'm amazed. So, his dad was a pastor for many years. He actually grew up as a pastor's son. And so Steve has a heart for the kingdom and for seeing people blessed. I just listen to his stories of how many people come to him for advice and the amazing advice he's given that's literally saved businesses at certain and save people millions. And so it's either you can really speak about this. So Steve, welcome.
Awesome, thanks. Well, that was very kind of you. Thanks, Andre. And to my horror yesterday, he said to me, do you have something just about your business background? So I gave him a LinkedIn profile. But you must realize that the profile is always pitched so you can get business, okay? So it always sounds larger than life. But God's really, really blessed. I'm going to share with you some stuff on wealth management, investing, and small business. I do speak very fast, so you're going to have to concentrate, okay? And the reason I'm going to go fast today is because I want to pack a lot into 40 minutes. So I'm going to give you some real little tips and bits and pieces here and there. But the main objective for me is to just give you probably three concepts I want you to really think about and spend time dwelling over, and it might just revolutionize your lives and change things as to how you see things, certainly in terms of wealth and planning your wealth. I want to just follow on from what Andre said earlier, just something on the spiritual aspect as well, and Andre's really covered it fantastically, the whole basis of spiritual prosperity. But the point I want to make here is that, or just a backdrop to what I'm going to say to you, is I want you to take it to extremes and say, this guy's just speaking about wealth, wealth, wealth. So I'm just going to put into context here for you and just give you one scripture in Proverbs 13, verse 22. It says, a good person leaves an inheritance for their children's children. That means to the second generation. So God wants to bless you to give. And we'll talk just now about giving as well, that it is a spiritual concept of giving or principle of giving. And if you don't have, you can't give. But if you're giving, God blesses you. So it's a real important part about giving in terms of creating wealth to live. Because if you don't give, you're not going to get. But a sinner's wealth is stored up for the righteous. That's marvelous. Those people out there not serving God have got no idea that stuff there is for us to take from them. So that's going to be part of today. I need my glasses for this part. And two more little bits on the spiritual side is, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. And you see a little man walking over there with earthly assets on the one side and heavenly riches on the other side. The point I want to make here is you're investing here on earth for living, but you're also investing in the kingdom. So always put that into perspective. Whatever you do and whatever you fill your mind and your hands and your time with, remember, you also want to create spiritual wealth up in heaven. A gardener's cottage in heaven or a mansion. It's up to you as to what you're doing for God's work. Okay, so that's in Matthew 6, verse 19, 22. Then the last little bit over here, the life of Job. Who knows about Job? Does anybody know about Job? All right. Now, often you hear people say, oh, that person's blessed. You know, God must really, they're spiritual or whatever. Or that person's not being blessed financially. Obviously not doing what they should be doing before the Lord. As Andre said earlier, that's absolute rubbish. The life of Job proves that to us because Job was obedient and Job lived his life sincerely before the Lord. And God, because of God's plans, there were times in Job's life where it was really, really hard and where Job really struggled and financially things were tight. But it was part of God's plan for his life, and not just his life, but what God is doing in the bigger picture. So if you're going through hardships and times in your life and you think, why? It might be God's working with your character or he's working with people around you. But in part of God's bigger plan, the measurement of wealth has got no bearing whatsoever on God's blessing upon your life. I want you to understand that. And you see here, after Job prayed for his friends, the Lord restored his fortunes, gave him twice as much as he had before. All his brothers and sisters and everyone who had known him and before him ate with him at his house. You know, the relatives come and eat and enjoy your wealth and riches. And they comforted and consoled him all over the trouble the Lord had brought upon him. And each one gave him a piece of silver and a gold ring. Look at the generosity. God blessed him just from those around about him and for himself. And the Lord blessed the latter part of Joseph's life more than the former part. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke oxen, 1,000 donkeys. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. That is blessing in terms of the natural. But Job's heart was right. Okay, we're not going to spend too much time there because I know you want to understand some things more on the practical side of life, okay? Right, what's so important here about life and money and matters is this financial cycle of life. Now, the amazing part is we all born into this world and then there's such a push for us to be educated and understand, you know, to get sort of a point in life where we can earn an income, support a family, and so it goes on. But for most people and for society, it stops there. It's this important rush to get through school and then get an education or get into a career of some sort, some practical training, whatever the case may be, and then you got a job and then that's it, you live. And you live and you live and you live, and then at some stage in your mind there's this thing about retirement, but you're not quite sure you're going to get there, but you know about people who have retired, so you must get there somehow. And then some along the line, somebody comes along and says, well, have you thought about this or investing here? And some people get lucky and do it, and some people don't, but we're so busy with our day-to-day walk, we don't really realize that we have to plan ourselves. How many of you drive a car? Everybody here drives a car? And do you take a car in for a service periodically? Why? What on earth for? It's a health check, isn't it? They're going to tell you what's wrong with your car. Brakes need adjusting. What happens if you don't service your vehicle? It's going to grind to a halt. Well, if you don't service your financial planning on in terms of where you are in life and where you're going to get to, and you don't have a plan about it, you can't benchmark or you can't decide, are you on track, are you going to achieve it, because you're so busy with just the nuts and bolts of life. You're driving that car all the time. You're not actually focusing on, I need to fix this, or I need to deal with this area, we need to adjust something. So looking at the picture from a baby side, your school child, you then go through your stage of studying, graduation, then the marriage part, and then, of course, life is all too wonderful and rosy. The kids come along, and it's so busy. It's transporting them here, left, right, and everywhere. I'm going through that phase now where it's like kids with transport and sport, and it's like you don't have a life anymore. You know? You're a taxi. And then, of course, you get the part where you finally start to stabilize things, and you get to a point with a ripe old age, you can enjoy life, and you can retire, and, of course, you get old sometimes, on your own in the latter part of retirement, and that is the life cycle as you know it. But so many people haven't really planned this financial life cycle, which obviously leaves them high and dry, and they get to a point in the latter part of their lives where they're suddenly, what now? So I want you just to think about the life cycle of life itself, and the interesting part about wealth creation, it's a time phase. You can't buy back time. There is only so much time that you have. I've just put over here that for typical, for most people, by the time they've done some studies or some form of studies and get into a position of working, they're around about the 23-year-old age mark. And most people try and retire around about the 60-year age mark. Some go to 65, some longer, some 55 if they've been blessed. But the point is, there's about a 37-year span you've got to do to create wealth or to create something to live on and to provide that for your generation of your children's children. The question for you today is, where are you sitting on that scale? You can see where I'm sitting on the scale. I'm at the latter part of it somewhere up there. But it doesn't really matter if you find that you are on the latter part and you haven't yet done something. Today's the day that you need to change your paradigm and think about, how am I going to address this and I can fix it? With God's help, you can fix it, and God wants to bless you. So I just want you to understand that we're looking at a timeline, and it's important to understand you can't create the 100% of your retirement in the first 5 years of working. It's not going to happen. You can't do it when you're having your children phase, because it's the investments of education and university, and so it goes on. So there come certain stages in life where you're able to save more, invest more, and certain stages where you have to spend more, right? So that depends on that cycle. But you need to plan that. So let's look at the next one over here. The important part about here is to determine and to track your wealth. Like we said earlier about taking your car in for a service, what's the condition of your vehicle? Well, same as what is the condition of your finances? Now, if you sit down and do a plan and you decide for yourself, okay, I want to retire at that age and by today's standards, I need to have X amount to try and support myself and my family or my wife. And I'm sitting at this stage here and with the inflation where I project it should be going, how much do I need to actually be able to retire at a reasonable standard of living? That's part of the equation you should be asking yourself and deciding what to do. And once you've done that, you need to then put down a timeline, put down a benchmark, and start measuring yourself against it. And I put down over here where you can see there's an actual and a planned, and there'll be a variance between it where you can see, am I on target, and reassess those targets. Now, the little picture over there is very avid, a little moving target. Every time you try and put a dart into it, the target moves. That is life, unfortunately. And it's impossible to plan things 100%, but at least if you've got an idea where you're going to, you can recycle that plan continually to see, am I on target, and what do I need to adjust to make those changes. It took me a number of years before I started to do that in my own life. And I was quite amazed because I then worked retrospectively. I then took the first 15 years of my working career, worked out more or less what I'd earned and what my assets and things were. And it came to some figure like I gained about 150 rand a year. Do you realize that? Am I laughing or joking? Or who's had that experience? You're actually no further ahead than you have been the year before. And then you think to yourself, how on earth am I going to get somewhere? How am I going to retire? And look at those people who have retired. How are they managing to do this? So it's an important aspect to, at some stage, discover that you have to get ahead and you've got to be able to achieve that. And I'm going to give you some tips, a lot of ways to try and get to the point where you can actually get financially ahead each year. Okay? Right, so we said the important part is to determine what is your net worth. I'm sure perhaps most people have dealt with a bank before. If you've tried any form of loan from a bank or any type of finance, they want to know what are you worth on paper. Because if they're going to take a risk, you're going to take a risk, and they don't know what you've got that they can grab. So who's worked out a net worth statement before, or a statement of assets and liabilities? All right. I've given you an example. It's in your pack there. I'm not going to go through all the detail. And this is no bearing on any particular person. It's not me. It's just an example to show you really how to work out assets and liabilities. And really what you want to do is the actual tangible assets you're going to list at the top and try and work out what those are worth realistically. So if you've got a car and you bought it 15 years ago, don't put this purchase price in because it's not realistic as to what it's actually worth. You've got to put a depreciated value. It's what the net value is today of that vehicle. And the same thing goes with your liabilities. And into your liabilities will come all the things that you owe money, your bond, whatever the case may be. Now, when you put in liabilities, take it one step further, make it realistic. It's redeemable liabilities, which means you'll see I've got an equation in there. Put in capital gains tax if you sell the property. Put in agent's commission because that's what it costs you to liquidate yourself. So at the end of the day, the benchmark you're looking for of your net worth is if you were to liquidate yourself tomorrow, what is your net sum figure on a piece of paper going to look like? All right? And what you should do is every year go through that calculation and measure yourself every year and say, okay, have I improved or am I going backwards? That's the key, the first part to benchmark. Because otherwise, you know, you suddenly live the good life at some stage in your life where you've got a good job, good income, so now you're driving a nicer car and you've got these nice holidays and you get this feeling inside, I'm actually doing quite well. But when you do your asset and liabilities list, you realize, ooh, I'm spending high, I look like I'm living well, but I'm going backwards. My net worth at the end of the financial year is actually worse than it was the last financial year. I must make some adjustments. Everybody got that part? All right, let's move on from there. So we talk about financial planning, and Andre said something earlier about planting seed. It's not going to happen by itself. As much as the faith you want to have, God certainly does not promote laziness. And what I'm saying by that is, if you're not going to go out and plant those seeds, God can't bless you with that seed. You've got to be active and proactive and say, what am I going to do about to be able to develop and grow myself? We'll give some more tips on that just now. The important part to look at is a current situation assessment. Where are you at the moment? Where you're sitting at the moment? And how far are you in this game? And how far have you got in terms of your financial planning? Are you on track with it? Do you have a plan? And are you going to be able to, is your plan achievable? Are you going to be able to achieve the goals? And do you need to adjust it? All right? The second part with that would be your actual plan and strategy. So draw up a plan. I'm going to do this on that date. I want to pay off the debt. And of course, what Sonic is going to speak about later, as to how you're going to handle your debt situation. I'm going to have a strategy in place. I want to achieve more passive income. That's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to research this area, and this area. I'm going to actively do this. My time scales are 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and so it goes on. If you put those into practice, you'll start to get somewhere because you're planning yourself. You're not just saying, well, it'll be nice one day to retire. It'll be nice one day to have some assets, and I'd like to travel. How are you going to get there? So you've got to have a plan in place, all right? Implement the goals and actions. You've got to put them into practice. No good just talking about them and planning them out. You actually have to be disciplined to do those things that you set out to do. Measure yourself against them. If they were unrealistic, readjust them, pray about them, ask God to help you and give you guidance, and go back to them again and stick at them. All right? And then, of course, evaluate and adjust. That's a constant process all the time. We don't live in a finite world where the dynamics are all set. The interest rate's fluctuating all the time, which can drastically change your budget or your plan. We live in circumstances where health might affect you, your job or career. You might get promoted and you get more increase, so you can then adjust your plan, so it goes on. So it's a constant reassessment, reevaluation cycle to see, with what I've got, where I'm going to, can I still do it or must I do something different? All right? So at this stage, I want to introduce to you something called the bucket ideology. And your life amounts to a bucket, not your bucket list. So your bucket. And in this bucket, there are just three levels we're looking at over here. The very bottom one is your initial working buffer. There's the little water level somewhere above that. Your family living buffer and your retirement provision. Now, whether you realize it or not, this is how you're currently living. In fact, we all live this way. You know each month you've got an income coming in, you've got to do certain things with that income, you need to have some left over, or you've got to pay off debt, and so it goes on. You've got this sort of money coming in this bucket or floating around, and it's going to be spent at some point in time as it goes on, right? So I'm going to take the bucket theory a little bit further here, and I'm going to say we have the inflow and we've got the outflow. And many of you spend your lives in that boat bailing the water half the time while it's busy filling up on the other part of the time. The interesting part about that bucket is now you've got this inflow. So for most of us, it's an active income. When I say by active, I mean you're working. You're in your job. You're earning a salary. It comes into your bucket. And the problem is this bucket's got some holes in the bottom. And these holes, you can do something about some of them, but not about all of them. And I'm just going to tell you what they are into four categories I've got there. Base living expenses, lifestyle expenses, investment expenses, and inflation. Now, you've got to deal with those four dynamics. To deal with the inflow-outflow, obviously the more you can put in, and if you take less out, the bucket's going to fill up and you're going to have more reserves or buffer for retirement. If you're going to spend a higher outflow, then what's coming inflow, what happens to your bucket? It's going to become empty, and you're now in trouble because the bank manager wants to talk to you. They don't want to talk to you when you've got lots of money. When you've got no money, they're suddenly very interested in who you are. All right, so how do we adjust this? And it's a very, very simple principle. You get a nice big funnel. You stick it on top of the bucket and you try and catch as much water or rain as you can. And you fill your bucket faster. Fair comment? So how do you do that? Can you work two jobs? Some people can. But you can do other things too. You can have passive income. You can have other types of investments which will give you income. All these resources coming in fill that bucket. We'll talk a little bit about those just now. At the other side of the bottom over here, you can try and reduce those amounts of cash that are going out. We call them financial hemorrhaging. And you can decrease those expenses. And that might be painful for some. We'll talk about that just now too, but it's a very important facet because at the end of the day, the only way you're going to get that level to rise is to fix more coming in, less going out, and that line's going to move up and down. It's literally as simple as that. All right, I'm going to give you a little tip over here, and I want you to just think about this very carefully. The majority of salaried people, or most people, live hand in hand, month to month. That means every month they spend what comes in and they worry the next month whether they'll be able to cover what they've got to, what their commitments are, put through the temps that goes on. Do you realize the amount of stress that induces in anybody's life? It's terrible. You're living all the time under sort of, can I make it? Can I make it? Can I make it? And if one little thing goes out, like for example, an unforeseen expense on a vehicle or whatever you've got to fix, it's suddenly, I can't pay for this now. How did, and the stress you get yourself into. So one of the biggest tips I'm going to give you is do your best to work as hard as you can, as soon as you can, to get 1 month ahead of your financial cycle. That means if you're living on 10,000 rand a month, and that's your income that provides the 10,000 rand a month, save and get yourself to a position where you eventually start a month with 20,000 rand in your bank. 10 was what you earned. The other 10 is your new buffer you've had. You're 1 month ahead of what you normally your living expenses are. You've got no idea how much relief that's going to give you where you realize now, I can pay that bill if it comes. I've got something to work on here. I don't need to max out the credit card because interest is a killer. You want to stay away from interest as much as possible. The next step is get yourself to 2 months ahead. When you get to 2 months ahead, you're looking in a pretty good shape because if you're not 2 months ahead, forget about passive investing. You don't have money to invest. Very important facet, you've got to get ahead of your monthly living expenses and costs, and you've got to get yourself there, all right? So we're going to get there. How are we going to do it? And here's the first key. I want you to listen to this carefully. Frugal living. Use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. You all got that. You don't need the new car. You don't need to upgrade your cell phone. You don't need any of these things. Seriously. We live a life where marketing and merchandising is pushing you to get the latest, buy the biggest, you must have, they've got it, you don't have it, you've got to have it. So what do? We live our lives in debt. We live our lives in spending stuff we don't need. And that's going to fall into the next slide, which I want you to look at carefully. Bad debt. So two little statements here. The first one is don't buy things you can't afford with money you don't have to impress people you don't like. And that is one of the biggest danger pits, you could say. In most of my corporate career was in Johannesburg, and I worked for two very large listed companies in the JSE, lots of staff in the company, and the most amazing part was the people that had the biggest debt were our sales staff. They lived the high life, the eating out, the cars, the fancy, they must have, because it was all about impressionism. And we didn't mind it, because the more the guy's in debt, the harder he's got to work to earn commission to pay off all this stuff. And they're borrowing against next month's commission, borrowing against 2 months. And the more he's in debt, the great, because the guy's got to work his backside off to try and pay the stuff. Well, it's just one of these pits that business puts you into, right? The little one on the right-hand side here, stop trying to keep up with the Joneses are broke. You won't believe the people you think are successful with the fancy assets are financially way overextended. And they've got no nest egg. They've got no retirement. They can't live to retire one day. They're going to battle. Going back to the Joneses and all these people, in 5 to 10 years' time, most of the people, maybe 70 to 80% of the people you mix with, you're not going to see anymore because they move on. So why are we impressing these people? Who are you trying to live for? Live to be true to yourself. Live for your family. Live for the Lord. Invest in the kingdom. You don't depress anybody. If you drive an old car, as long as it's working, who cares? It doesn't have to be the latest vehicle. Hey? Not right. Not so. It really doesn't matter. Because the poor person that's bought the latest model is suffering to pay it off. And they're not enjoying it. The pleasure's gone because it's a noose around their neck. And Cindy and I know in our lifetimes we bought a number of new cars. We try not to anymore. And you realize the minute you bought this thing, 30% of the value is gone the minute you've driven off the showroom floor, right? And then you realize it's not the right vehicle because once or twice in our lives we've made mistakes and bought sports cars. They're two-seaters. I can put the kids in the seat in front next to me, but Cindy won't go in the boot. So the problem is you have to sell the sports car. Then you're losing 100,000 or 150,000 rand on the price you paid for it. It's got 10,000 Ks and the clock was the wrong car to buy. And you tell yourself, well, I'm stupid. Why do I do that? We make these silly mistakes in life. We do things because we're trying to impress or we want to make feel good about ourselves or whatever. The whole issue here about wealth management is get away from that. That's the second tip for today. You don't have to do it. Live frugally, and you don't depress anybody. Be true to yourself. You can live in a lot less. If you're going to eat out, be conservative. Don't start with a pudding, a main, and a starter, a main, and a pudding. You can eat a lot less. And save it. Rather go out twice. Or bless somebody else with it. Making sense, guys? Alrighty. Now we get to the good debt part. Now, most people don't believe there is such a thing as good debt. Of course there is. I can see a few of the accountants here saying, what? Okay. There are certain types of debt which are really good and they're fine, acceptable, because you can't grow without them. Non-income generating would be things like your personal home loan. Very few people can go and buy their first house cash. If they can, then something happened, they inherited or something. But for most people, you have to acquire debt of some sorts. For most people, really, realistically speaking, it's invariably going to be a vehicle and home finances, or the two types of finances that you kind of have to get into at some stage. If you can get away from the personal finance on vehicles, great. But obviously, some jobs require you to have a newish car if you're doing repping or whatever. So you've got to lease it or finance, and so it goes on. So those are acceptable. It's paid for. It's part of your whole package, how you're trying to deal with things. But the non-income generating side, and I'll talk just now about the gearing aspect, but you have to incur those sort of types of debt. The other income-generating long-term types of debt would be the vacation loans. Few people can study and do degrees these days unless they've got bursaries, but they have to pay for it, and that's acceptable. You're investing in an education which is going to be used to work and pay off what you've owed the financial institutions down the line. So those are acceptable as well, but plan them well. Don't go do 7 degrees in a row and then only use one of them. Okay, and the other part would be business venture capital in terms of income during long-term loans. But be careful with any type of business capital. Do never try and invest in something unless you can afford to write it off. Okay, that's a very important key. If you don't have the reserves or resources, and why I say sometimes you'll say, well, why then borrow money for a business? It's sometimes because you have your assets or money actually tied up in something else, like properties or whatever, but you've got the assets to gear or leverage against to do the business venture. and it's a calculated risk. But if things go wrong, sell one of the properties, settle the debt, and you're out of trouble. Okay, but if you haven't got the reserves to do it, you can't do it. Okay, so there are some times where that kind of finance is okay to use. Then, of course, your income-generating debt is fine, residential property, commercial properties, and we spoke about business investments being very careful again. Right, so I'm going to move on here. I'm not going to have too much time to be able to cover a hang of a lot, so I'm going to go through fairly quick. In terms of any type of loan that you do have, gearing of the loan to an asset is quite important. Don't over-gear, which means there's a magic number in property, for example, never gear more than 20% of bonds against the actual asset finance, which means if you've got R1 million worth of property, then don't over-gear more than 200,000 rand of it. Okay, now that's not always possible, understand that, but if that is your method of investing for a long term, then you'll speak to anybody who's inside that game, they'll stick to this magic number of 20%. Because if there's an unforeseen circumstance or inflation hike or whatever, you can, out of your income, afford to pick up the balances and pay off those extra amounts and still stay liquid. If you go high on those margins, you put yourself at great risk because suddenly you've got to service much higher bonds, higher than a 20% gearing, all right? So we just realize there's gearing there to take into account. The second one is the ability to service the loan. That's very important. Think of the eventualities. If the business venture doesn't work out or whatever doesn't work out, how are you going to pay for it? You've got to have backstops to pay for it. You can't just go into something and say, I'm borrowing money and I just trust the Lord. Well, the Lord wants you to trust what he's given you, a brain first, before you trust him to give you something for nothing, okay? And then, of course, volatility in interest rates, it's something we can't do without. It just happens. We live in a very volatile economy. And, folks, this is something you can't – it can suddenly shoot up. We've seen property interest rates shoot up in past years. Just be careful. Always be aware what happens and the what-ifs. All right? Let's move on. Now, the income-generating side, there are just – I put here four different categories. There's the active income, that's the people employed. You're actively working a job, you get paid a salary. Second level is professional, and what that means, you like in a little medical practice, you have staff, you've got a secretary, and you've got a medical assistant and yourself. You are developing income derived out of using resources or not just yourself, okay? And the third level over here would be the enterprise. That means you've got a business, a company, you employ people on a more formal basis. And then the last level, the top level over here, is your passive income, which means you've done the setup right, but you're putting the least amount or less effort into it to maintain the money coming in. Okay, so everybody in your career or lifetime strives to try and achieve, by the time you retire, this passive income portfolio. You hear people talk about passive income. It's because they're not working so hard to try and bring the money in. It's working for them and producing. Okay. Sure. Okay, so a typical example of passive income would be, let's say, and I'll give you an example now, you've bought a second house and you're renting it out. So you paid off the bond or a large portion of the bond, and the rental income coming from that now is an income to you, but you're not having every day to go into a job to receive the income from this property. Okay, we call that type of income passive income. The other type would be you bought stocks or shares, and you've taken earnings and profits you've got, you put and bought yourself stocks and on the JSE or whatever, and as obviously the values go up, you're now earning something from that, but you're physically not working it. Somebody else is working it for you, okay? That's passive. Active, you're doing the job. You're selling ice creams on the side, you're doing sewing on the side, you're repairing cars on the side, or you're working an active job that's active income, okay? So you decide on that mix and what that ratio is going to be. In certain portions of your professional career, it's going to peak that you're very focused on the active income side, just where you're working and zoned in. Because let's say if you're a lawyer, for example, every hour you can bill. It's like the lawyer who died and went to heaven, and the Lord said, according to your billing system, you've been alive for about 250 years. Right, in your pamphlets, you've got a little one-pager there, which is an example of a property investment. I'm not going to spend time going into it. You can look at it for yourself. But what I want to show you here, the illustration was, on the left-hand side was just a typical budget of a family. And Sonic is going to touch on doing budgets just now. And that gave us a certain value at the bottom. You could see it was a surplus of typically 1,560 rand a month. And what I've taken there is an example of buying a house. Buying a house for 1.2 million, putting down a deposit of 400,000 rand. Remember, folks, if you don't have the money to put the deposit down, don't buy a house. You need to have some gearing there, okay? Don't get yourself into debt where you overextend. So you buy this thing, try and get 100% bond on a second property. You're going to put yourself into a terrible state. So you then take a bond for, say, the 800,000. You get your prime minus 2. Of course, the interest rates changed since I put the slide together. And there was only three finance ministers ago, which happened in a very short space of time. And we go right down to the bottom over here. We had net profit over here of about 1.3, sorry, of the property. So I've taken into account the fact that you've paid rates and taxes, all the different provisions for the second property, and after rental income, you've got the 1,330 extra income coming in, okay? Bring it through to the right-hand side, and you can flush it down with all the extra expenses you would have, et cetera. The bottom line is, you've got 1,048 Rand left at the end of the month versus the previous time, 1,560. But in real terms is you're paying 500 Rand a month extra to pay off an asset, a property worth 1.2 million. You see? Because what you're doing is you're using your rental income or the interest portion of the rental income to offset against your taxes of that income. So you're getting fantastic growth. The value of the property is going up and up all the time, and you're not being overtaxed by having that whole amount being taxed as full net income. Do all the accountants agree with me? I'm going to just blank stare, Kerry. Okay, cool. Just to show you very quickly, this is the boom and bust cycle that happened. There's one that happened in 1981, one in 2004. I'm not going to dwell on it too much, but to show you the price fluctuated, they shot up at one stage. Some people that got in, for example, in the early 80s, bought property, and their property portfolio suddenly was worth a lot more when it got to 1981. It then dropped down again after that and crashed. 23 years later, we saw another boom in 2004, and it peaked. And, of course, we've had some prices come down since then and go up. And this next slide over here just shows you very briefly the typical projections of where prices have gone and where they're going to go to, let's say on property. In 2013, if you had a house for 1.191 million, then in 2014, 2015, there was roughly a 5% growth per year. That's not bad that you've got your property, your investment you've done growing by 5% a year, and you still have, if you paid off a large portion of your bond, that extra income coming in as well. So property is a fantastic investment, one of the better passive investments you can do, but there's lots of types of passive investments you can do. Right, create more investments that produce passive income. So by the time you want to retire from working, you have a sustainable income that does not result in eroding your capital. Very important. Now, starting a business, we're going to touch the next part over here. The very important part about business is it's all about risk and reward. So you feel like this little mouse with a crash helmet on, there's the cheese, there's the trap, you're going to go in the trap, or you're going to get zapped. So very important, four real aspects about it. I'm going to go really quick, folks. There's four components to business. The first one is time, effort, money, knowledge, and experience. Too many people come to me and talk about they want to start a business. The first thing I said, you have the time to do it. No, not really, but they're really busy, but they've got a good idea. They've got the money. They're going to do a business. So you're going to fail. Why? You need the time. You've got to be able to have the time to do it and put proper energy and effort into it. Effort-wise. Be able to achieve it, or hire somebody to do it and put the effort in for you. Money, very important, you need to be able to achieve with that, and of course, knowledge and experience. Don't try and start a business you don't know anything about. It's going to fail. When it comes to business, take passion out of it. Whenever somebody speaks to me about they've got this wonderful idea and they're so excited, and can they come talk about their business plan, and they discuss it, and the first thing I say to them is, look, you're really enthusiastic, but your enthusiasm is like, that's all you got, because the rest ain't backing it. Take the enthusiasm right out of it. Look at it from a cold heart basis is, will it work or won't it work? So there's some points we're going to go through. Viability, do you have the knowledge or experience? How will you fund it? Where will you locate it? The business models, test your ideas, understand cash flow, implementation plan, and constant assessment. I'm going to go into that now, and I haven't got much time left, so I'm going to go quite quickly again. On the viability aspect, remember the SWOT analysis, those are in business, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Do your homework first. Is this a viable business venture I'm going into? Is it achievable? Can I actually sustain what I'm trying to get to? The second one is, do you have that knowledge or experience? Or can you get that knowledge or experience? Do you really know what you're trying to go into? Because the competition out there sure does, they know what they're doing. The third one is, how are you going to fund it? And the important point I want to make here is, can you afford to write it off? If you're going to go into any type of business, in small business or opportunity, use capital or use resource reserves. You can afford to lose tomorrow, walk away and say, it was a good, I tried, I won some, I lose some. Okay. And many successful men today or women today have actually been bankrupt two or three times in their lives, surprisingly. I'm not going to name them all now, but there are lots of examples of those. Little point here, while you're doing business and while you're doing finance, your partner says, would you stand surety? Don't. It's actually not biblical either. It says, put judgment to co-sign another's note to become responsible for his debts, Proverbs 17, verse 18. Watch what you sign with the banks. Watch what you commit yourself to. A little piece of paper that you sign for surety for maybe a little loan for some equipment actually is tying you to any finance that company has in future, down the line. Little small print everywhere. Be careful what you sign for, okay? And if somebody wants you to if you have the reserves to give them, rather give it to them without expecting a return. But to lend it or do surety side is just putting yourself into a terrible situation where you're compromising your own financial security. If they can't do it themselves, they shouldn't be going into business. Location is extremely important. Location, 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 especially in retail, obviously. Where you locate your shop, I put a map of East London. If you're in the medical profession or whatever, you've got to be where it's happening. You can't go and put yourself out at Cinsa and try to attract East London people. It's not going to happen. So that's quite important to achieve that. Now, what is really important, guys, and this is the business models of your business plans. I put there four categories. A lot of people talk to me about, and they've got one plan. This is their business plan. They want to go and start this venture. Here's their business plan, and it's normally the optimistic plan they bring me. And you know what's going to happen? It seldom gets achieved. So the realistic part is, work your optimistic plan. This is the potential of my market. This is what it can do. If everything's 100%, this is what I can do. But then give yourself a realistic plan as to what you really think ideally you could possibly achieve based on the factors and circumstances. Then you must give yourself a break-even plan. So what is the minimum sales must do to pay what my cost and overheads are to flush out or be neutral or zero balance at the end of the month? All right, very important. And then you've got to have an exit plan. So what happens if I fail? How do I do damage control? I mean, yes, you've put capital in and you might lose that, but the ball's rolling. You're now going to pay accountants and auditors and this and that. You have to cash reserves to wind up a business. Make sure you've got your exit plan in place, otherwise don't start a business. Also, now what's extremely important is counsel. You know, we all get these good ideas and we go off, we're going to achieve this and do business or whatever, and sure we can. But you know what? You need to talk to people around you and find people that have experience in that field and ask them questions. Don't always select the guys that say yes. Go to those that you think are skeptical and say, tell me why you're skeptical. Why do you think this won't work? Pick their brains. And then with that advice, pray about it and ask God to know. You know, God will open and close doors for you if you do all the homework properly and trust him to open and close the doors. God will really come through for you. But you've got to be faithful in doing that homework to ask people and get counsel, get advice. And in the Bible says, in the seed of many counselors, there's wisdom. The more people you ask, the better idea you're going to get as to what the viability is. Cash flow. You can have an extremely successful business. You can have a large business, but cash flow will kill it. And what that means with cash flow is, if you don't have the working capital in that business to carry through paying your creditors while you're busy redeeming money for the sales, you've got outstanding people owe money in the business, so it goes on. You talk to anybody in the accounting side, and the audits on company, whatever, they'll tell you the companies suffer the most with cash flow. And if they can't get their cash flow cycle right or can't get their cash flow right, they're out of business very quickly. You are basically trading insolvent. And in this country, you can do it legally still trade insolvent. In other countries like Australia, your CEOs don't get arrested for it. You go to jail if you trade insolvent without advising you about to go into it and declaring it and getting permission to continue. Right, so cash is important. Now, the implementation plan. We've got to put things in practice. You're not going to achieve it unless you really have a strategy of how you're going to achieve this. So it's all one thing to have good ideas. You worked out the sums. You've got a business plan. It's going to be, you can do it. But how are you physically going to do it? And this comes with implementation plan. The literal who, where, when, how, why, and an ability to roll it out. A lot of people try and go into business. They haven't thought this through. And then suddenly, I've got to do the job of five people. and they don't have time because they're doing another job at the same time. And then suddenly the whole thing collapses. You can avoid a lot of the problems by doing all this up front and trying to minimize your risk by strategically deciding and planning where you're going to go to, how you're going to do it, and make a quality decision before you get into it. Then there's the constant assessment, which means constantly going through the evaluation cycle while you're doing this, while you're rolling out the business, and while you're working in the business. Do the health check. Are we good? Are we bad? Are things working out? Are we making a disaster here? Were my assumptions correct in my business plan? Must I readjust it and then correct for it? So important, because otherwise we go through blindly, suddenly we realize, we ended the financial year and we 150,000 in the red and I can't get out of this, and the problem gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And what happens for many people? Pride comes in. I'm not going to let this thing fail because everybody knows I went. They said I mustn't do it. I've done it. I will make it win. I will succeed. What happens next year? The bank repos the house and the car and the. So, folks, be realistic with yourself. If something, there's a saying we have, which is the first loss is the best loss. If you're getting your head over water or underwater and it's not working out, pull the plug. Go and get counsel, get some help, pull the plug. Don't drive a business thing through because you feel, I must make it work because my pride's at stake here. There's no harm in changing tack and saying, this didn't work, I'm cutting it, I'm trying this or doing whatever. That's what business is about. It's unemotional. Do it for the right reasons. You're investing for the kingdom, investing for your retirement, you're investing for your family. Always have the right mindset in place and God will bless you for doing that. Okay, so we have the thing on ethics. And this you could spend a whole day on, but there are biblical ethics which work in any business. You know, the unrighteous use Christian ethics and succeed very well at business. There's no replacement for a man or a woman of integrity and honesty and generosity and all those parts that go with it. Apply those to business and you'll be surprised how people respond, especially today's day and age where we are so taken advantage of and you get nothing for your money. Go the extra mile and see how people will talk about you, and you, that goodwill does so much creativity for your business and blessing to your business. So bottom line is, God wants you to be blessed. I really believe that. And it's not just financial blessing. It's blessing you in your life as to how you live your life. Blessing you in your day-to-day walk. Blessing you in that you're not stressed out financially. Blessing you that you know that no matter what happens or when you start on this road of investing for retirement, for example, it doesn't really matter. God's going to still take care of you in your old age. Any questions, folks? Okay, question was, how do you improve your cash flow? Well, I think the biggest factor would be planning, because what most businesses, if you're talking about a business, for example, the cash flow cycle normally, the catch in the cash flow cycle, where a lot of companies get caught out, is their VAT return cycle. It's a two-month cycle. So what they do is they will buy in stuff, they're only selling it, but you have to then pay the VAT over, and you haven't necessarily redeemed the money on, because you've got to, you know what I'm saying? They get caught out between the buy-sell cycle. It's one of the areas that a lot of companies have a problem with cash flow. The second part is if you do, for example, business like projects, where it's a huge amount outlaid on your part before you redeem the capital coming in. The way to fix that is be more realistic when you quote and put in, for example, drawdowns. I want a certain percentage deposit to start the project and then my drawdowns as it goes along. So you're doing your cash flow management built into your project plan. All too often, we're too eager to get the business. And the problem with any company, if it's in my pocket for longer, I make the money, not you, so they'll squeeze you. So you've got to come creatively with them saying, look, let's negotiate about this. Let's try and be realistic. I can give you another 2% off the bottom line, but I need to have drawdowns or certain payments. And bring those factors into it to determine that you're going to stay in a safe haven, you could say, from a cash flow perspective. Stay away from going into debt, obviously, because debt is designed in such a way it's going to strip you of all your profits. Yes. Okay, the question is, what is the best way to do investment? Go to a bank or a professional institution, do it for you, or do it yourself, right? And the answer to that's going to vary, because not all people can have the time or the energy on hand to go and do it themselves. So they're reliant on the professional industry to go to them and say, I've got X amount of money I need to invest. Can you help me? All right. There's nothing wrong with that. But you must remember, they are making money on your money. Nothing's for free in this world. There's no free lunch. So first prize, if you can do it yourself. If you can do it yourself and you can do property or do other types of investments or stocks and shares yourself, you're looking after it, and whatever you're earning is directly to yourself. Nobody's taking a percentage off the top, right? These other institutions, obviously, they tweak themselves to give you as little as possible and take as much in return. I'm not being nasty, and if anybody's in that industry, I do apologize. But that is the nature of the industry, and the entire industry is like that. That's business. So the attraction's always wonderful. You can, for example, you can invest now and earn that then, and it looks like a lovely figure, but in 25 years' time, that figure is not, you won't buy a loaf of bread. It becomes Zimbabwean money. So the golden key here is always try and work it yourself. If you can't, but you, understandably, some people in a profession, they can't. They're too busy. Their hours are taken up. They can't, but don't sit on it. You've got to do something. You've got to be investing. So go, for example, into a consortium. There's a lot of people who invest in property where four or five get together and they buy a property. And one of them says, look, I'm pretty good at watching property or doing the finance. I'll handle that aspect. You see? But at least then you're involved in something. Keep your eye on it. Get the financials on a regular basis. Check what's going on. Make sure that your partners aren't taking you. But that's the golden key. Whatever you can do for yourself is going to work out better in the long run. But there are professionals that will help you, but it's going to cost you a little bit of that slice. Okay, that's a good, absolutely a good question, and that's what Steve's asked about is insurance and how does that come into play with this whole aspect. The short answer of that is it varies depending where you are in life and the stage you are in life. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is, you'll know that there'll be some people that self-insure. You've heard the term self-insure. Notice some companies have a fleet of vehicles. It costs too much to insure them, so they actually carry the insurance themselves because they've only got 100 vehicles. So if one gets written off every 3 months, it's not the end of the world. It's cheaper to replace the vehicle than to pay insurance on all those vehicles. All right. Now, that concept takes your own life as well. When it comes to anything financed, like a bond or a home, you have to insure it. That's not an option. You're compelled to. And, of course, property you need to insure for certain aspects. But there's some other types of insurance you can take risks on. For example, your working insurance, professional insurance. If you're in the peak of your career and there's a chance that something can happen, you can't provide for your family, well, then you need to insure or have professional insurance that if you're disabled, it can carry and provide for you. That's a necessity. But when you have retired and you've got your nest egg to provide for you, you don't need that insurance anymore, okay? The same would be there are certain phases in life where you need, especially, say, when you've got a young family and stuff, and now you're working to try and build something for them, then short-term life insurance is very important because if you die tomorrow, something needs to settle that bond and carry your spouse and family to the point where they can live and sustain themselves. So that's good type of insurance, right? But when you get past those years and if you've been financially blessed and you've got your own cash reserves, there's no point in paying off another institution for that risk element because you carry your own. You're worth X amount. If you die tomorrow, your family's blessed anyway, so it doesn't really matter, you see. So it all comes into equation or assessment while you're looking at where you're at in your life cycle as to what you need, what you don't need. That whole thing about frugality, don't be irresponsible, but be frugal. If you don't need it, don't take it. The same, and because the other tip with life insurances or these long-term endowment policies or whatever, yes, they do pay out. But there's no ways that financial institution can give the results that you yourself can achieve if you really apply yourself and do passive income. That's a fact. As long as you're wise about it. Don't just go off and buy the first house you see. Do your homework. What is the area? What is the yield like? Do they sell well? What's the typical rental income like? Can I achieve? And from that perspective, then you do the purchase because you've planned yourself well. Yes. Yes. Well, yes and no. It depends again on your strategy as to how you do. So your question was about is it wise to take a percentage of income into retirement annuities because of the tax benefits on them, right? Remember that the tax structures are worked in such a way that ultimately SARS is going to get you one way or another. So you're never going to win the SARS. And they've closed a lot of the gaps. For example, on property, a lot of people made more money on flipping properties at some stage, buying, doing up and selling. But with the capital gains sitting so as high as it is now, you're actually losing. By the time you paid that and paid the agent's commissions, it's actually not worth it. So we speak now about when you buy property, you buy it for life. You're buying it to keep it and stick it away. Now, I don't have time to go into all this, but there's a whole lot of other aspects in terms of financial planning, like, for example, creation of a family trust, putting things in your trust, protecting it with your estate, and all that kind of stuff, which is all part of your plan to make sure that your assets and your wealth will carry on to your next generation without being most impacted by tax. But at different stages in your life, especially the younger portion of your working career, these retirement annuities are very important, because you don't have maybe the capital reserves to do some of the other passive income. So a good mix of it is important. Start with having the stuff to get yourself going. But once you find you're generating enough capital to go and buy passive income or do passive investing, you'll find that the increases and the returns on those will outstrip all the typical commercial ones that are available, because obviously they're not making the money anymore, you're making the money. And from there, trade the two off. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah, okay, so the question is, what would the recommendation be if you're starting out in career to start planning towards your retirement one day? What's the steps you'd take? As I said to you, it's very dependent on your stage in life, right? So in the beginning, when you start your first salary, you don't have capital to go and buy another house. So you've got to start doing things. First, you've got to protect yourself from an insurance perspective. If you're a professional, you want to have that professional indemnity and have that other insurance to cover yourself in case you can't work, incapacitation, right? So that's protect, at least you can earn if something happens to you. Then you start the next part of saying, well, on a smaller scale, I want to ensure that I have something by the time I get older. But the problem with most people is, I'll give you an example. There was a medical doctor, an anaesthetist some years ago, he's no longer in the country. So I can use an example, and he came to have a chat with me, he was a friend of mine, and he said to me, look, when he's been working for many years, he's a similar age to me, and when he started working, of course, the insurance people came to see him, and as time's gone along, he's just taken more and more and more insurance policies out. Right. And I was staggered, he's paying about 75% of his income into insurance policies. Okay? The problem was, the redeemed values were peanuts compared to what he could have done if he'd done property or something else. And he was I could work another 10, 15 years, but I can't retire on this. And that was a big, it was a shocker to him. as I said before, that is the problem with the nature of any of the commercial stuff. I'm not knocking anybody in the industry, but it is designed in such a way that they make the wealth and not you. But they've got to give you something. So use it when you need to, but when you get to a position where you don't need to use it, move yourself more where you're in control of your wealth and where you got the passive income to look after yourself and take it further. That is the golden key, really. In anybody you'll see who's financially managed to sustain themselves late in life, ask them the question. They're not all sitting with massive RAs or endowment policies. It's all based on the fact they've got a portfolio of some form of passive income that's generating for them on a continual basis. Because most passive income keeps pace with inflation. Your house asset goes up the value. Your rental income goes up with inflation. But when you take out an insurance policy, they will keep increasing your premiums, but you'll notice that the true redeemable value is certainly not keeping up with inflation. If they say to you, oh, you're going to get 20 million in 30 years' time, 20 million in 30 years' time is not going to, it'll probably be worth, say, 200,000 rand today. You see what I'm saying? Even though they increase it and they say, yeah, we're upping the value, it never catches up. And of course, the other part with insurance, as we all know, is as you get older, the premiums hike up because of your age. So invariably, it gets to some cycle where it gets so expensive that you're just, it's not going to, you know, it's going to be like, can I really do this, you know? Sorry, the question is, if you take a portion on, you think on retirement annuities and a portion on say, for unit trusts or money market or whatever it case may be, you know, what is the right ratio? As I said, you know, it's very difficult to quantify and say in your circumstances what is right, what is wrong. The golden key is to sit down and say, what is this doing for me and is it working for me? So you saw earlier the slide with risk and reward, right? So any of these investments that offer you or promise you higher returns have higher risk to them as well. And you need to decide, is that a worthwhile risk-taking to invest in it? Obviously, if you're prepared to take the risk, you can get a much bigger return than a more stable type of investment. But that's an equation you have to work with constantly all yourself. My advice again to you is, work with it to a point where you have enough to start investing in passive income for yourself. And when you get to that threshold, redeem some of that, put it into your own investment, and from there keep growing. And before you know it, over a couple of years, you'll suddenly realize, hang on, my portfolio has grown significantly enough that I actually don't need these other things anymore. I look after myself, you know? And that's the blessing or the benefit for you. Yes, you won't ever fully retire because you'll be watching and looking after your passive income or passive investments in your latter years. But that's acceptable. It's a percentage of your time and not 100% of your time. But far better than struggling where, how on earth am I going to keep part of the inflation? I mean, you've all seen it. People who are real professionals, top in their field, they retire, and 8 years later, they're working for a company in a menial job because, and you say, what happened now? Oh, just be struggling financially. Just think, you don't want to be in that position. And the only way to get around that is to have something that's keeping pace with inflation, and that is passive income that you're in control of. Sure. Oh, one last question. Yes, anybody?
Absolutely.
Lovely question. Okay, so the question is, what sort of short-term insurance or life insurance should you be looking at to cover the eventualities? Should something happen to you? And yes, would the new husband be driving your speedboat? A very important question there. The first thing is to tell your spouse never to sell things at the price you told her you paid for them. That's the first thing you must always tell her, but that's a joke. I always give Cindy the price I pay for things in dollars, so she's quite sure it was rands or dollars and how to multiply it. But the bottom line to that is just ask yourself an honest question. If you died tomorrow or you were to decease tomorrow, what does your family need to support your wife and your kid, realistically speaking? So it's going to be a case, settle the bond, pay off the car, and have something that they can invest that gives them an income. Obviously not going to make them super rich, but you're wanting to a middle point so they can live. Now, if it's in a younger couple and, say, your partner's still working, well, then they've got to hire somebody in to daycare, and there's all those extra expenses. So that's really the equation. If somebody tries to sell you something and say, no, listen, if you die, your wife is a multi. She can go and live in Milan and buy herself. Well, that's not necessary. I mean, you'll be paying a huge amount for it, and that type of insurance has no return generally, because we're talking now about short-term life insurance where you're buying a huge value, but you've got to die first. And, of course, the other key is if your marriage is not on the very, very solid ground, don't take it. You'll be fed poison mushrooms. Do not take it. It's a get-rich-quick scheme for the other partner. Folks, thank you very much. Bless you all.
Thank you, Steve. So Hold on. I think one of the keys is because, I mean, there's a whole lot of information and it's only relevant for certain types of people in certain situations. So I think the key is to take everything he said is you need to go plot yourself. You need to go find out where am I? And for some of us, it's, I need a job, you know, so you start over there, you know, so there's, for some of us, it's really, you need to come back all the way to here. I need to find a job. I need to get myself equipped to do a job, etc., you know, so I just want to encourage you, don't be overwhelmed with everything, but take it to the Lord and say, okay, God, just go, I'd say, go and sit, type out or write down, this is where I am, go do that. What you called it, asset and liabilities list. Find out where am I, and then you need to, like, okay, what's that next step? Just try and break it down. Just simplify. What's that next step to move forward? Okay.